This is BI Radio.
It's all about your behavior. Show that you have some of those trusting values.
What is innovation and how important is it, and how do we determine whether it matters or not?
Well, innovation is very important, obviously. Otherwise, people wouldn't do it.
Companies are kind of like sharks in relationships, and if they don't move forward, they die, right?
It's not about giving people lots and lots of information. It's about giving them the information that they need to be able to take action.
Hi there, and welcome to BI Radio. I'm Ken Seeley. On the show today, trust, innovation, and customer success. Core values at work at IBM. We hear about reporting success at HSBC Hong Kong. Next, our technology soup panel is back to explore innovation and why it matters. But first up, soft skills coach Mark Jeffries returns with some ideas to build trust into your business relationships.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Howarth. Core IBM value is trust and personal responsibility in all relationships. IBMers work hard to actively build and preserve relationships with all the constituencies of our business, including clients, partners, communities, investors, and fellow IBMers. So today I'm joined by Mark Jeffries, who's become a trusted advisor and communications consultant to some of the world's largest and most successful companies. Mark is a talented speaker who regularly appears as an image and communications expert on network television news, finance, and lifestyle programs. Here, he joins me to discuss his new book, What's Up With Your Handshake, and share tips on how people can convey a more open, trusted, and respectful image in the workplace. With me on the phone, I have Mark Jeffries. Welcome, Mark.
Hello, thank you for having me.
In your book, What's Up With Your Handshake, you advise people on how they can use soft skills to win. In essence, the book shows ways that people can present an image that's open, generous, adaptive, and thoughtful. Obviously, most people want this kind of image, but why do so few people do this successfully?
We all set out hoping to please our clients, to demonstrate that they can trust us and that in many ways we're going to be completely responsible for everything we do and say. But what often happens when it comes to the point of the sell, and let's face facts, that's what we all do, we all sell the whole time, we forget all of that and we become obsessed by the message we're trying to put across. And when that happens, we start to forget the person in front of us. And the whole secret of strategic communication or soft skills is about relentlessly considering the person in front of you, what it is they want to see and hear, and then adapting your message to suit that. And that's a great way to create a very high level of a generous feeling, an open nature, and real trust in a relationship.
In your chapter on the five stages of successful networking, the first stage is establishing trust. Can you give us some tips on how people can quickly establish trust when meeting someone new?
Trust is a toughie at the beginning because, of course, trust builds over time. Every time you demonstrate that you're a great person to do business with, you become, as a result, more trusted. But if we think about how we make choices in our general lives based on a product we've never used before, we will trust perhaps what other people say. We might even trust a very impressive advertising campaign. So it's about the message you put across. It's about how you act and behave in front of someone. And if you've got any mutual connections, it's about invoking those as well. The more little ticks you can apply to this kind of trust checkbox, the more the person in front of you is likely to trust you. But it comes with time. So initially, it's all about your behavior, how you behave in front of someone. Show that you have some of those trusting values, i.e. that you listen. That you respond to what's being said, you take notes, and you act accordingly.
Originally, the handshake was a symbol of trust. You were showing that you didn't have anything in your hands. Can we talk about handshakes a little bit? What's the proper etiquette for handshakes?
Yes, we can talk about handshakes with pleasure. You know, I use the handshake as kind of a metaphor for the whole book because the handshake, very often, is the first impression. and we only get one chance to make a first impression. The point I make is very, very simple. It's this. We notice something that's slightly askew. We take note when something is not quite right. And so the handshake actually is very, very important. And nobody ever corrects another person. You'll never meet someone and go, nice to meet you, Joe. What's wrong with your handshake? We'll never say a thing. So people go through lives, their own lives, believing they've got it right when in fact they have not. Now, in the grand scheme of things, it's not a deal breaker, but it will tilt the scales against you slightly if your handshake is just a little off. So it's important to get it right. And getting it right very briefly is, duration-wise, a two-second maximum. One, two, release. In terms of if you're a guy, you've got to keep your hands nice and dry. And there's a very simple solution for that. You just go and rinse your hands with cold water before you shake anybody else's hand. And your hands are dry for like 20 minutes. The water obviously cools the hand down, but it also acts like an astringent and it takes that clamminess away. The other thing, of course, is strength. How strong should your handshake be? Well, the rule is simple. Just match strength. Match what's coming at you. So if you're shaking hands with someone with a very delicate handshake, you don't want to be like a total fish, but you don't want to crush their hand either. Match the strength that you find.
A key IBM value is the idea of preserving trust even after a relationship ends. Do people generally consider this as much as they should? Are there simple ways that people can stay in touch and connected?
Yes, there are. I think you're right. I think a lot of people see a deal not happening, often at the end of a relationship. Or indeed, something has gone wrong and there's a lot of bad feeling, and therefore that signals, once again, the end of a relationship. I believe very strongly that you should never burn your bridges, because you never know what's going to happen in the future. I used to work in television, and there was an old phrase in television which was simply this, be nice to people on your way up so that they will be nice to you on your way down. And that's because TV very much is like that. You get all the way to the top and then people love to knock you down. Business is different, but you never know who's going to cross your path again in the future. So the simple rule is this. Keep yourself on the radar. Even when a relationship has effectively ended, even if it's temporary, make sure you reach out and connect with that person maybe once a month, a quick email. And you want to have some value in that email. Maybe it's a link to a website with some interesting content. Maybe it's a cut-and-paste story from, say, the Wall Street Journal or Barron's financial newspaper with something you think might interest them. Just keep offering them these nuggets. And trust me, a year, 2 years down the line, they'll be back for more business.
Your book states that the one thing harder than becoming a success is staying one. Can you explain?
Well, this is difficult because you sell yourself hard to get up to the top. And whatever your product or your service is, you sell it very, very well, very conscientiously. And finally, you get the deal. People think you're great and you're set, or at least you think you are. The problem is all those promises you've made, all of that good feeling you created and goodwill has to stay. It has to stay consistent, and that's really hard. That means you've got to keep doing what you were doing for the rest of the business relationship or the duration of the deal. And so it's very easy with the excitement of the potential of the deal to sell yourself hard and become successful. But to stay there is a little harder because it requires you to constantly keep thinking about everyone, keep thinking about the deal that you've done, but at the same time be selling for the next deal and the deal after that and the deal after that. Very simply, in the world of strategic communication or soft skills, you are always on. You never reach a point where you can go, done it, fantastic, I can switch off now. You're always on. And the problem is this. You can be the most successful, articulate, wonderfully mannered, perfectly behaved person, but one day you lose it, that's what everyone remembers. And so, unfortunately, the difficult news is that you play the role for the entire career that you're choosing. Which sounds difficult, but you know what? Once you're committed to it, it's not that bad. Just remember, you're always being observed.
For more information on Mark Jeffries, please visit his website at markjeffries.com. That's markjeffries.com.
Performance 2008 is your direct path to performance management expertise and the most important one-day event of the year for anyone who's using, supporting, or evaluating Cognos solutions. Get practical knowledge you can use right away. Meet product experts to learn how to increase the value of your current investments. Performance 2008 takes place in dozens of cities worldwide. Registration is free and it's open now. Get on the path at cognos.com/performance2008. Interviews, insights, and opinions on performance management. You're listening to BI Radio.
Hi, I'm Don Campbell, Chief Technology Officer.
I'm Stefan Ju, Technical Architect.
I'm Andrew Kelly, Product Manager.
So today we'd like to talk about innovation that matters. So everybody does innovation or claims to do innovation, but really, what is innovation and how important is it and how do we determine whether it matters or not?
Well, innovation is very important, obviously. Otherwise, people wouldn't be purporting to do it. What I find is that it's harder to do innovation depending on the environment. So it becomes a challenge for a very large enterprise to continue to innovate. And because everyone recognizes it's important, there are things that need to be put in place to make that easier to happen.
But large corporations got there for a reason. And, you know, companies are kind of like sharks in relationships. And if they don't move forward, they die, right? And something else will take the spaces and take the money away from them where they do their business. So it's important that they come up with new ways of fending off other people who are just as hungry for that next dollar as they are.
But culturally, there has to be something in place to allow them to contribute in an effective way.
Yeah, it's important to maintain that as much as possible and probably introduce new things to help sort of scale up the innovation process.
And the innovation that matters doesn't always have to be homegrown either. Part of the way a company, for example, might choose to move forward into a new market space is identify innovations that others have made and move forward with them. People tout Apple all the time as being such an innovative company. And they are, and you know, some would say that, you know, more so than the likes of a Microsoft or whoever who constantly copy, but where did Apple get the idea for the mouse? It was Xerox PARC. You know, it's an idea of sort of looking around and seeing, hey, and the whole idea of what matters is seeing some kind of technological innovation, a business model innovation, and then applying it to a new space.
That's a good example of actually a pro of being a large enterprise. Sometimes the surface upon which you can innovate is much larger. Just because you're a bigger company, you have more resources available to you, you can almost do innovation at a meta level as opposed to always being the one guy who has to do everything from scratch.
Sure, but that environment, because it's so large, has to be a little bit more prescriptive. You can't be quite as ad hoc about it. You can't have individuals sitting in their own offices or cubicles or working on various things independently without a way of sharing and communicating and joining forces when innovations really can be brought together and have more velocity and more strength.
Yeah, in smaller organizations where things are certainly riskier, you can't hide from the market so much, because if you spend a lot of effort innovating on something and the market doesn't like it, you die. And it's like it's like natural selection. But you know, the larger an organization becomes, it's easier to isolate some of these innovations. But the problem too is that some of these innovations need time to foster and need money to foster. There's a reason why, regrettably, these super colliders and, you know, hadron colliders and so on that they built are, you know, so monstrous, 27 kilometers, you know, dug out of the Alps and whatever they do now to do those kinds of tests. There are only certain organizations that can handle certain types of innovation. And so having a large organization doing that is good for the deep pockets too.
And I think you have to be willing to let things fail, depending on how risky and how edgy you want to be. If everything you do in your innovation cycle is going to market, then maybe you're really not pushing the envelope enough.
Some of the old chestnuts too, like the glue that's used in Post-it notes was supposed to be the perfect adhesive that would never come apart. And
right.
They end up being, hey, it's low residue and reusable, and then it opens up a new area. A little bit of basic science, if you have the resources, can lead to those kinds of, in that case, I believe it was 3M, those types of innovations.
And that's a great example. And be willing to look at something that maybe has a slightly different outcome than the original purpose and be able to take that into a brand new area. That's innovation in itself, just recognizing that.
So how valuable is innovation just in and of itself? The fact that you have a culture that supports innovation keeps people's spirits up, keeps them wanting to work in your organization. Google does that a lot, and they talk about having 20% of their time being accessible to projects that are outside of the normal business day, and that makes people drawn to companies like that because they know they get that opportunity.
Yeah.
And innovative thoughts and ideas really need to be mined. They need a place to go to where they know they can at least be given the opportunity and the support that they need. There's a lot of young minds that may be coming up with great new thoughts, but wouldn't have a clue how to take a product to market or deal with downstream implications or all of those things around the business model, then they can make those innovations much more successful and they don't feel they have to do it all on their own. I think that's a big part about bringing out innovations in your company and not just hoping they will come out.
Well, and not, you know, literally, well, somewhat literally reinventing the wheel. If within, you know, a trusted organization you want to be able to innovate, it would make a lot more sense for people to innovate on incrementally on stuff that people have already done rather than having four or five people sort of coming up with the same idea and running with it as far as they can and keeping it in stealth mode until the last possible minute, which simply just causes confusion.
And for large organizations, you might be talking about crossing borders and time zones, and it's just not practical to understand what's going on in the development organization of a different country, even within your same organization. But understanding, you know, a place to go where you can find that information so you can learn to join forces and build something collaboratively, I think that's a big part of pushing an innovation forward.
Now, some people would say, well, look at Apple. They hide their stuff altogether. When they're working on something new, they have, you know, these guys locked up in a bank vault-type lab, effectively, to churn out these new ideas. But, like, how do you actually glean that kind of thing without being so open that your competitors can just walk all over you in advance of you? Is the real protection time to market? Is that the real way to make innovation that matters, is make sure that when you do innovate, you think about such things as, well, somebody else is coming out with this, so we better follow this path of dropping a particular idea into the marketplace. I mean, bottom-up groupthink, groundswell, whatever you want to call it,
right,
can generate a lot of really interesting ideas, but we all know cases where people run around and there's inefficiencies and so on. And, you know, does there need to be for a real successful innovation? You know, you go up high enough, there's always one person. Does that have to be the case for innovation to succeed, for innovation to work?
I don't think so. I think there are different levels of innovation, and I think we need to recognize that some of the innovation, as you alluded to earlier, isn't necessarily just a single project. It's more like taking what's available to you, and some of that may come from within your company, some of it may come from without. But clearly, the larger your palette of innovation is available to you, the better that meta-innovation can happen, and the closer you'll be able to hit that market.
So innovation that matters, it's all about helping to drive the business forward, it's efficiencies, it's about exploring new markets, it's about enabling customers to be successful and more competitive in what they do with your products and services and technologies. There's a lot of white space out there, a lot of opportunity to innovate. And so we certainly are recommending that companies put effort into it, put some budgeting aside for it, and churn out as much innovation as they can, because this is a great place to be. Thanks, fellas.
Thank you.
Bye.
IBM Information on Demand 2008, the premier information management event for business and IT professionals, and Cognos and IBM Company will be there. Choose from over 750 business leadership and skill-building sessions, 60 deep dives into Cognos products and solutions, and the latest on Cognos and IBM integration. Join MC Martin Short at the Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas, October 26th. Early bird registration closes August 15th. For more information, visit cognos.com/newsletter.
Insights on performance management from the people who shape the industry.
Hi, I'm Kelsey Howarth. For banks, a single view of data and fast answers are critical. Here I speak with David Campbell, Head of Business Intelligence at HSBC Hong Kong, about how they use Cognos to unite systems and processes. and how they reduced reporting times from 7 weeks to 7 seconds. Thank you for joining us.
Okay. Thank you.
Could you tell us a little bit about HSBC Hong Kong?
Yeah. HSBC is one of the world's largest banking groups, and in Hong Kong we're responsible both for Hong Kong, which is one of the major contributors to group profit, and also the countries of Asia-Pacific, which is around 18 countries, which vary in size from some quite small operations in countries such as Mauritius to larger implementations in countries like India, China, and obviously they're going to be growing quite dramatically, or hopefully growing quite dramatically in the coming years.
Could you tell us about some of the central issues or pains that your organization faced before Cognos?
In Hong Kong, we'd been very good at collecting lots of data, but what we'd not been very good at doing was getting that data out to our users, and even when we did get it out, it was always very late, through multiple systems, multiple formats, multiple versions of the truth, multiple definitions. So it's very difficult to form an overall picture of what was going on, to relate activity with outcomes, to understand performance against plan, to understand where we needed to improve. And even where we could do that, we were not doing that on a timely basis. And that's where Cognos has really come in and helped to change the whole operating environment for data.
So once the decision was reached for Cognos, where did you start? What department or what area was the first one?
Okay, we were very focused on the personal banking business. So this is the retail branches that you or I would see on the street. It's the internet banking service, it's the call centres. And we've initially focused on Hong Kong, so that's one of our major operations, around 200 outlets across Hong Kong, plus a comprehensive web solution and a fairly active call centre. Within that, we took the decision not to focus, as many projects do, on reporting to senior management first, and then taking that down through the organisation. We started at the other end and started by looking at the information that our branch managers would need to manage their branches effectively, and that the branch sales teams and anyone else in a face-to-face position with customers about the information they would need to optimise their day and maximise their output. This had two benefits. One, by focusing on one particular area, we didn't overscope the project, we weren't too ambitious. It enabled us to deliver a working solution very quickly to establish credibility for the project. And since then, we then go through a process of regular quarterly releases to build up the scope and capabilities of the project towards eventually a full dashboard for senior management and information that would support or will support in due course our product managers, our channel managers, and our marketing teams.
Last year when we spoke, you mentioned that it was taking about 7 weeks to get the quarterly reports?
Monthly reports.
The monthly reports. Yeah. Can you take us through what was happening to take that amount of time and how you changed that?
Yeah. So what we used to do in terms of centralized reporting is we would produce monthly reports. They would take about 3 weeks to produce. So they would then go out to the branch teams, and the branch teams could look at that information. But if you're producing something 3 weeks after the month end, any activity that took place at the beginning of the reporting month is actually 7 weeks old. And so that's just too late to react to it. You might have had a serious issue that needed some attention. You might have had a great success that really needed some immediate feedback, some immediate rewards, some immediate encouragement, and so on. So we were losing the immediacy of the data, the ability to react to that in the proper way. And that was really just embedded in our systems. Our systems were maybe in the mid-80s, maybe that was an acceptable way to run banking, but certainly not the way that you'd run a retail operation. It's not getting on top of the issues that you need to address as a sales manager, as our branch managers now should be. You need that immediate feedback. You need to be able to say, did we manage the branch? Did we manage our activity properly yesterday? Do we know what activity we've got coming up today? Do we know what's coming up tomorrow? Can we plan for that? And are we seeing the right sales results coming through? And is everyone in line with the performance we expect from them, or are there some issues we need to address, or is someone overperforming, and is there anything they can share that we can learn from both within the branch and across the wider distribution network. So data reporting really helps get that focus. It's not about giving people lots and lots of information. It's about giving them the information that they need to be able to take action. So as far as possible, we have high-level information that allows the branch manager to look at a wide range of information very quickly and just identify the areas where they need to intervene and take some action.
That is a tremendous outcome. Can you think of any other outcomes in terms of time saved or money saved or new insight?
In terms of savings, there was a fairly significant saving from day one. Because we weren't producing the information in time, many branches, and our branches were arranged in groups of 10 as a district, with a district manager heading that up. They would put in place a lot of manual processes to track their performance, but these would vary from district to district, so we couldn't form an aggregated view. And it was very, very time-consuming in terms of individual salespeople tracking their results manually and then submitting those results to maybe someone in the district team who would then spend probably all day compiling those results and producing some daily analysis. We were able to eliminate that effectively overnight. When we launched the new system, the next day that just all disappeared. And overall, that actually freed up about 23 people to focus, instead of being full-time on collating and delivering manual MI, they're able to focus on their proper role, which is supporting the district team and actually helping to drive performance and deliver the plan. And across the sales force, we saved around another 70 FTE equivalent just from the time released from not having to track manually every day, record and log, submit, check, cross-check, etc. And earlier this year, we actually reorganize the branch network based on our greater level of understanding of how the branch operates, what customers actually want, who they're seeing, what products they're buying. And we can also map sales type against customer type, so we segment our customers. So we could get down into quite a lot of detail about what our customers actually wanted from us. So we could align strategically our branch network and the design of our branch teams around our customer needs.
For more information on Cognos Solutions for Banking, including the full HSBC Hong Kong case study, please visit www.cognos.com/banking.
Want better visibility into your bank's performance? Cognos is the Hubble telescope for banking's black holes. With 17 years of proven performance management experience, like our performance management framework that shows you the sweet spots of information that truly make a difference to your performance, or our IBM Cognos performance blueprints that give you a head start to better decisions in key areas like customer profitability and risk. Get better visibility into your performance. Visit cognos.com/telescope today. That's cognos.com/telescope.
Well, that's a wrap. I'd like to thank our guest today, communications consultant Mark Jeffries. From our technology soup panel, Don Campbell, Stefan Zhu, and Andrew Kell. And from HSBC Hong Kong, David Campbell. A special thanks to our contributing producers, Kelsey Howarth, Delaney Turner, and Lisa LaRochelle. Thanks to producer and audio engineer Derek Schrainer, who composed all the original music you hear on BI Radio, and for making us sound so good. A reminder to check us out online at radiocognos.com, where you can listen to previous shows, download individual segments, and view the transcript of each broadcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Ken Seeley, and we'll see you in about 6 weeks.
Got perspective? Cognos Performance Perspectives is the Cognos e-newsletter for business intelligence, enterprise planning, and performance management. It's your source for exclusive interviews, insights, and opinion on industry trends. It's a perspective unique to Cognos, one we think you'll enjoy. Get the newsletter and get a new perspective. Subscribe now at cognos.com/perspectives. bank.com/newsletter.
Performance management you can listen to. This is BI Radio.